And welcome to the Way Back When podcast, episode 3.
Hi!
Yay, we made it. This is really weird. So yeah. we're separated again. Mm-hmm. We're in two very different places. We're hundreds of miles apart, but we're still doing this.
Yeah.
And what time is it? It is 3:20 in the morning.
Is it that late? Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And wow. I have flatmates, so I don't know how loud I'm being.
Yeah.
Am I being too loud? No, I think I'm being okay.
Fine.
But yeah. We have thick walls. But yeah, so I am up in Manchester and Maria is down south.
Yeah, still in London.
Yeah. And I will be looking off the side because Maria is like down in this direction for me at the moment. But yeah, we're here. I've got a lovely fireplace next to me. Mm-hmm. I have Isabel from
Very
Animal
cute.
Crossing. And yeah, thank you. So before we start, I think we need to say like some thank yous for everyone who shows support on the first two episodes of the podcast. We had so much fun.
We did.
Just like putting them out there and stuff. I mean, I didn't have much fun editing at times.
No.
The editing can be a nightmare, but we did it. It's out in the world. And so if you've seen the first two episodes, thank you so much. Thank you so much for all your love and support. If you haven't seen them, go and check them out because we were talking about Vibia Sabina and Anne Boleyn.
Yes.
And I know we both had a lot of fun both like making and like editing and putting those episodes out. So if you haven't seen them yet, go and check them out.
Yeah.
We are all over social media. Our Twitter is officially working.
Yay.
Last time we were recording, the Twitter was not working. Mm-hmm. We now have a Twitter.
Yes.
It works. Maria is in charge of the Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
So if anything chaotic or cancel-worthy happens, it's her fault, not mine. So we're on TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, everywhere. You should be able to see the links around us.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so Maria, do you want to introduce what we're talking about today?
Yeah, so originally this was mainly going to be focused on Elektra and like specifically talking about her interpretations in plays. But I did indeed leave all of my annotated play copies at home, at uni, sorry, not at home, I'm at home. So I'm going to do more of like a narrative based House of Atreus, Trojan War, what happens after the Trojan War style video.
So it's a bit of a yappy one today.
Yeah, it might be less structured than the last two purely because of its mythology and like literature rather than history. I know it's like it's a little bit different from the real stuff, but as you can see from my background, I do like mythology, and I will be talking
about... You do like your mythology.
Yeah, equal parts mythology, equal parts, like, Roman Greek history, so...
Yeah. Awesome! So,
yeah.
I know very little. Once again, all I know is just stuff that, like, you've told me about, so I'm going in, like, semi-blind.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm really looking forward to it. So do you want to like start us off? What are we starting with?
Yeah. So I don't know where to start. I might talk about the plays first. So
yeah, let's go into the plays.
Narratively, the plays are separate from the Iliad and the Odyssey by Homer. So we have these two Homeric texts by a guy named Homer, which you may or may not know about. Homer is... So he's a poet from archaic Greece, which is a long, long time ago, like 600 BC, 700 BC, roughly. But we don't really know if he was an actual person or he's become this, like, he's just the name we put to these works. So
there's this
kind of conception that the texts of the Iliad and the Odyssey that we have in ancient Greek are probably written more in about the 5th or 4th centuries BC.
Okay, yeah.
Because there's this thing called, like, the Dark Ages, which we don't call it the Dark Ages anymore, but after the collapse of the Bronze Age, which I will be talking about a bit more in the video, writing kind of goes out of fashion, and then after the end of this collapse we see literature start to flourish, and this is where we kind of get this telling of the House of Atreus and Elektra's story. So,
Yay!
yeah, any I can get straight into it or
Oh yeah, absolutely. Just dive straight in. Like,
okay.
let's introduce some characters. What we're talking about.
Okay,
I'm
so
excited.
the main narrative will be following a family. I believe it's four children and two parents. Talking a bit about some uncles and aunts, but for the main part, it is King Agamemnon of Mycenae, Queen Clytemnestra, also of Mycenae, but she was a princess of Sparta, and their children, Iphigenia, Chrysothemis, Electra, and Orestes. So, yeah, there's four. I'm gonna stick with four because narratively it changes depending on like which reading you're going into, but I prefer the cohort of children that I'm choosing to talk about, and I don't really care about the other ones, so I won't be talking about them.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
So is it because this like the original like first time this was written down, it was so long ago that there's been so many like rewrites and translations and things have got like mixed around?
Kind of. So we originally get the Odyssey and the Iliad, and Agamemnon is a main character in the Iliad. He's the king of kings. He's the main, kind of the main reason we have the Iliad. He steals Achilles's consort, his slave that he gets given as war booty, basically.
Yeah.
And the whole Iliad is the last 50 days of the Trojan War. But the Agamemnon we see in the Iliad is different from the Agamemnon we see in the Odyssey. The Odyssey is kind of where we start to see the beginning of this like House of Atreus tragedy. But I would say that it really starts to flourish under the tragedian playwrights of the, I think it's the 4th century BC. I have a bit of trouble with the math, so bear with me. But
Yeah, no worries.
yeah. So we get like Euripides, Asclepius, and I've forgotten the third one. But yeah, there's three main authors who
Yeah, you know, you
talk.
see, I should know this because
Yeah,
I literally
you should.
just did a
Yeah.
module where I'm sure if you've seen the first episode, you know that I am a costume design student and we just did the Bacchae.
Yeah, you did.
So I know a little, I should know the names as well, and completely forgotten, probably because it's 3 in the morning,
Yeah,
but it's okay,
it's
we
fine.
roll. We have clarifications
Yeah.
for a reason.
Yeah. So, we get these playwrights kind of playing with what they're given, which is quite normal. They have mythology, they have lore that they're given, and then they write their own version of it. So, like, they'll have different versions of, say, like Oedipus's story, or like Andromache and Hector's story, or Hecuba's story.
So you're literally telling me this is literally just fan fiction?
See, I have a problem. Yes, but I tend to argue with people on TikTok about this. I would say yes, it's probably fan fiction. People weren't worshipping these stories necessarily, but the
Yeah.
characters in the story were being, not all of them, were being worshipped in terms of hero cult.
Oh well, yeah, just from my own knowledge and my own research with the Bacchae, like obviously Dionysus was
Yeah.
someone who was worshipped. Like the Bacchae was first performed at the Festival of
Yeah,
Dionysus.
the Dionysa, which is a it's a festival in Athens. It's a literary festival, and I think there's a section for comedies, there's a section for tragedies, and there's something else. But yeah, most of these plays are actually written for the purpose of these contests.
Yeah,
Yeah.
and they'd like compete
Yeah.
and like there would be like the one that is like
Yes.
the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, I know stuff. I know
Yeah.
stuff.
So I'm gonna probably go with, in terms of the Electra side of the story, Euripides is one. Only because I tend to prefer Euripides. I think Asclepius is just as good. He comes a bit before Euripides. Because Euripides is kind of like overshadowed a little bit by like this master of tragedy, and only starts winning things once Asclepius dies. But yeah, they have competing narratives of things. And so in the Odyssey is where we start to get this narrative of this family. It's quite tragic. Like, it's full of murder, it's full of like intrigue, it's full of affairs. It's like everything you want from an ancient Greek tragedy.
So it's basically like a soap opera.
Literally, it's the original soap opera. So in the Odyssey, it actually, I can't remember what book it is, but they talk about it a lot in the final book of the Odyssey, book 23, 24. And then we also get it talked about in the Book of the Underworld, which I can't remember the books, which I should know because I have to write essays about this. But yeah, the Book of the Underworld, when Odysseus goes to Hades, he's sent there by Circe, and he encounters his old his old leader Agamemnon. And Agamemnon and Odysseus is surprised that he's dead, because I mean, he's supposed to have returned home from the Trojan War that they've been fighting for the last 10 years. And Agamemnon informs Odysseus that he went home, and on his return home, his wife's lover Aegisthus kills him while he's in the bath and usurps his throne, which, amazing. That's stuff.
Bit rough, to be honest. Yeah. Can't lie.
And we don't get reason for it in the Odyssey, other than I think it's just like family strife. And in the Odyssey, we kind of get Clytemnestra painted as this very like wicked figure, which she is painted as in the tragedies. I would say a bit kinder in the plays than in the Odyssey. Obviously, they're not the main point of attraction in the Odyssey. It's Penelope and Odysseus. So they used sort of a point of contrast for Penelope and Odysseus, who were like the perfect Greek couple. She spends 20 years waiting for him, and he...
I've been listening to that one song that's been trending on TikTok.
Oh, yeah, epic.
Would You Fall in Love with Me Again? Yes. I think that's what it's called. Yeah, I love that song. Oh my god.
Yeah, it's very good. I've warmed up to epic. I'm sure we'll do some episode about Penelope or something one day, because I do love her. But yeah.
Well, I've only like dipped my toes into it because like the song has just been like massive on TikTok recently. It's so good.
Mm. And Penelope's actually Clytemnestra's cousin. But I will get a bit more into the family tree once we start discussing more in detail the family. So in the plays usually all take place from the point where either Agamemnon's murder or the years following Agamemnon's murder. So narratively what happens is Helen of Troy gets abducted by Paris, and there's this oath sworn by all of the Greek kings that they have to protect Helen. They can't fight over her hand in marriage because she was like the most desired woman in all of Greece.
Yeah, like it's the ship that launched ships. Yeah.
So Menelaus and Helen are married. Paris steals her. Menelaus is Agamemnon's younger brother.
Yeah.
So Menelaus is king of Sparta, which is where Helen and Clytemnestra are from. I think if you're following, please do stop me and ask questions. so yeah, we got Clytemnestra and Helen and Agamemnon and Menelaus, and their two sets of siblings married to each other. And then obviously Helen gets abducted, Agamemnon wages war on Troy, and basically he sails from Mycenae to Aulis, which is a port kind of close to Troy. It's like the main point of land that they need to get from to Troy, because Troy's in like modern day Turkey. We'll put up a map somewhere.
Yeah, we can put up a map.
But when he's in Aulis, he shoots and kills a sacred deer of Artemis, and Artemis is really mad. And she's so mad that she stops all of the wind. And this seer, Calchas, goes and speaks to Artemis, and he's like, what do you need in order for us to sail to Troy? Because we need to fight this war, we need to get our honor back, we need to save Helen. And Artemis is like, I want you to kill Agamemnon's firstborn child. And everyone's like, well, we're not doing that. And Agamemnon's
a bit steep in it.
Agamemnon's like, no, we are doing that. And there's a really good play about this called Iphigenia at Aeolus by Euripides, I think. But I believe in Iphigenia in Aeolus, she gets transformed into a deer at the last minute. Mm-hmm. She doesn't actually die. But in a lot of... That might be wrong. That might be Iphigenia amongst the Taurians. Anyway, she gets kind of lured to Aeolus with the ruse that she's going to marry Achilles, who's also there, of course, because he's fighting on with the Myrmidons. And obviously when she arrives, she gets led to a sacrificial altar and killed.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Quite a warm welcome, isn't it?
Yeah, by your dad. You're getting murdered by your dad when you're supposed to get married.
Lovely.
Amazing. And obviously Clytemnestra, her mum, not overly fond of the murdering of her first child.
You wouldn't be too happy about that, would you?
No, you wouldn't. But she can't really do anything. I believe Odysseus is the one who kind of like keeps her distracted while they murder her child, which...
Lovely.
I am an Odysseus hater. I will always be an Odysseus hater. It's I'm so sorry. Epic will not turn... Well, it might turn me a little bit. But, yeah. She gets murdered. Clytemnestra goes back to Mycenae. I mean, she can't really do anything else. The Greeks, the Achaeans, they sail on to Troy. They fight a war for 10 years. And in these 10 years, a lot is happening in Mycenae. So we get Clytemnestra kind of being appointed as regent, like regnant. On behalf of her husband, and he kind of trusts her to run the kingdom while he's gone. I mean, this is happening all over Greece. Penelope's running Ithaca while Odysseus is gone, not amazingly. But yeah, other people, I don't know who's actually leading Sparta because nobody's in Sparta, but
just let them get on with
Sparta's
it, really.
Will work it out. So all the wives and all the, like, just imperial people of these houses are running the kingdoms on behalf of their husbands. And it's kind of, like, this portrayal of women leaders in Greece as being evil and malaligned, and Clytemnestra can't help but, like, start an affair with her husband's
with her brother.
No, it's not that type of story. She has an affair with her husband's cousin Aegisthus.
Nice, good work.
And Aegisthus is actually, I've got my little family tree here. Aegisthus is from the line of Thestes, okay? And Agamemnon and Menelaus are from the line of Atreus. So Thestes and Atreus are brothers. Atreus founds the kind of Electra Agamemnon line, and Theseus finds the Aegisthus line. But
okay, I think I'm following. I should have printed out my own family tree so I can follow along. But yeah,
one here. But Theseus actually has a daughter called Pelopea. And there's a whole narrative thing where Thestes and Atreus are fighting for the throne of Mycenae. They keep overthrowing each other, they keep exiling each other. Atreus feeds Thestes' sons to him at feast.
Ew, no, that's horrible. No, that's actually grim. Absolutely not.
Yeah, I think that's correct. And
you didn't tell me this was like cannibalism, Jesus.
Yeah, there's a lot of cannibalism.
Oh my god.
And Atreus and Thestes are actually the son of Pelops, who is like he gets eaten by the gods in a different story. Basically,
Jesus.
Agamemnon's great grandfather is Tantalus. And Tantalus tricks the gods and makes them eat his son, which is Great. This is, and we kind of get, Jesus. This is the conception of the curse. This is where we kind of get, like, the curse of the House of Atreus from. But yeah, these two brothers are fighting. Pelopia is the mother of Aegisthus. But Pelopia isn't married. And the father of her son is her father.
Ew, not again.
Yeah, because I believe she's in the House of Atreus when he comes and, like, sacks the palace in revenge for his sons being eaten by him. And I believe that he's, the idea that he's either frenzied with madness and he assaults his daughter and gets her pregnant.
Lovely. Yeah. Why does it always come back to incest whenever it's one of your episodes? Jesus.
We talked about it in your episode as well.
I know. Why have we, like, in every episode so far, incest has come up? Yeah.
Yeah. So Aegisthus is kind of, he's out for revenge. He blames Agamemnon's family for all of the strife. He gets, I believe he gets exiled. I think he gets exiled.
People usually do in these stories. There's a lot of exiling, isn't there?
Yeah. Pelopia actually kills herself because she can't deal with what happened. But she gives birth first, I guess. I don't know. But then Agamemnon and Menelaus get overthrown, and then they come back and then they kill their uncle, and then...
This really does sound like a season of Hollyoaks.
It kind of is.
Like, it really is. Although, and I mean, it kind of is, because, like, this is how storytelling was formed. You know, like, we get all of these tropes from
these
ancient
people.
Greece.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, obviously, I feel like most storytelling originates from, like, religion and mythology. And the way that Euripides and everyone was, like, retelling these stories, that is how, like, storytelling came about, like, tragedies especially.
It's not even, I wouldn't even necessarily call them retelling, because at the time that these authors are writing, it hasn't necessarily been done before them. It's not like, say, like Madeline Miller or Jennifer Saint, who are kind of retelling these tragedies. These are kind of, they're picking from already originated mythology and probably lore and folklore that they've already known and have been told, and they're kind of just putting it into, like, a narrative format.
Like, bringing it all together,
And, like,
but even, like, them creating that kind of structured narrative has obviously, like, stayed with us.
Yeah.
And, I mean, has inspired, like, countless authors, like, over the years. Like, Shakespeare was very inspired.
I'm so sorry. Like, since I've started properly reading Greek plays, because before I only used to really read, like, Medea and Heracles, like, over and over again. But since I've, like, properly been, like, I think I've read most of the surviving complete Greek plays at this point. I'm a bit short on the comedies, but Shakespeare just copies all of them.
Yeah, no, exactly. And he gets a lot of the credit for, like, tragedies and stuff, but that was not him in any way.
Give my boy Euripides his name back. My God.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Yeah, father of tragedies. Thank you.
Yeah, definitely.
Anyway, so yes. Clytemnestra's having an affair with her husband's cousin, who is of dirty origins. And I do think there is... No, literally.
Harsh.
He's literally of dirty origins.
Yeah.
But we kind of get this, especially in the Odyssey telling of it, this very clear idea that Aegisthus being born from, you can beep this if you want to beep this, like, rape and incest.
Yeah.
His birth in itself is, like, an insult to the gods, and his existence on Earth is kind of, like, a polluting force.
So he's cursed.
Yeah, they're all cursed.
In that sense,
We kind of get this idea of miasma, which is this Greek conceptualization of you can actually infect a society around you. So I believe it's, like, it's death, birth, and sex are the main points of my asthma. Mm-hmm. And it literally, like, they believe that your presence will infect those around you. And Clytemnestra, in the Odyssey telling of it at least, is kind of just this, like, this contrast to Penelope in that women regents aren't a good thing. Like,
right, okay, yeah.
Women in these powers of, in these positions of power aren't always amazing as Penelope is, and like the fidelity isn't common. Like, Penelope's the exception compared to like someone like Clytemnestra and someone like Helen, who in a lot of stories is kind of painted as this like seductress, which she's not. She was abducted by a horny teenager.
Ugh,
yeah, Paris.
But all the blame has to go on the women.
Yeah, and they're sisters. So, I mean, we kind of get this point that, like, their own family isn't doing great. So, yeah, I'll go back to the narrative and then we can discuss more in detail, like, the analysing of it. So, Clytemnestra and Aegisthus are kind of given 10 years to plan their revenge against Agamemnon. Aegisthus, for just, like, the murder of his, like, grandfather, and his mother, and then, like, what happens with Clytemnestra. And Clytemnestra's revenge is obviously because her daughter's been murdered, at least in the play version of things. And he returns home. They fight the Trojan War, they defeat the Trojans, Achilles is dead, the Trojan War thing happens, the Trojan horse. So Aegisthus and Clytemnestra, obviously, they have a long time to plan their revenge, and Clytemnestra is very upset over the murder of her husband. And Agamemnon's back. He has fought the Trojan War, he's won the Trojan War, mind you, by, like, very close, near the end of the war.
Yeah, it's a close call, yeah.
Yeah, near the end of the war it started to get very close, especially with Achilles dropping out and then blah, 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 blah. But that's a different episode.
He left the ring early.
Yeah, and then he dies, but they win the war anyway. So, they do the Trojan horse thing, everyone starts to go home, everyone and their grandmother returns home before Odysseus, but it's okay. And then Agamemnon's home, and I kind of just want to, like, focus on this idea of he's got, in this point of the story, three surviving heirs, three children. Yeah, he's got Chrysothemis.
Because the first one got sacrificed.
Yeah, he did that.
Because Artemis was pissed off. Yeah. Okay.
Chrysothemis, Electra, and Orestes. Obviously, Orestes is his heir. He's a male.
Yeah, he's a male, yeah.
Yeah. And Orestes is quite young. I've seen different interpretations in different plays and different retellings, but by the time Agamemnon returns home, we assume Orestes is about, he's either, like, 10 to 13.
Right,
yeah. Because he still classes as a boy, he's not a man.
Okay, so when's he a man?
It changes.
They're always changing their minds, yeah.
So usually it's roughly when you start to get facial hair.
Okay, yeah.
So, depending on, like, maybe, like, 15?
Like, 16? 15, 16,
20.
Yeah.
I mean, Telemachus, Odysseus and Penelope's son, isn't a man until he's 20. Which is crazy. I know that boy was shaving in secret. Anyway.
Oh, yeah.
But, yes, Orestes is about, I'm going to go with 10 for the sake of the narrative.
Okay, yeah.
Because it's an easy number. Orestes is 10. Yeah. Electra is probably, like, 15 to, like, 20.
Right, yeah.
Or, like, 13 to 20. And then Chrysothemis, we're not actually sure on where in the birth order she comes in. She's actually only seen in one play. So she's either younger than Electra or a bit older than Electra. Not sure. I just like Chrysothemis. She's one of my favourites. But yeah, Electra is very excited for her father to come home. Orestes, I don't think, cares much. he's a boy, he doesn't really mind. He's not really grown up with Agamemnon because he's been at war for 10 years. And Agamemnon returns home, and two things happen. Clytemnestra prepares the house as if she's like, "You're home, welcome, husband. Splendid return." She decorates everything, makes nothing's amiss. He doesn't think anything is amiss. The children aren't present, which is actually something I believe he notes in Agamemnon by Aesculapius. And he puts his foot in it a bit more than he already has by bringing Cassandra, Princess of Troy, with him. And she's his concubine, slash, like, slave that he's stolen as, again, war booty. But we kind of get this narrative that he's very much in love with Cassandra. He's, like, besotted with her and kind of married her as a second wife.
Right.
Which, not on in ancient Greece.
It doesn't fly. Yeah.
No. So if his wife wasn't pissed about the fact that he murdered their daughter,
he's really going for Husband of the Year award with this one,
husband
isn't
of
he?
The decade. So even if she has forgotten about the daughter murdering, like, he's rocked up with a priestess and be like, "I'm married to this one."
Oh my god.
And actually there's they believe there's evidence that they had two twins children together,
right?
But I can't remember what source that was from, and I remember reading that while I was doing my archaeological work.
Mm-hmm.
So that could just be based on Mycenaean archaeology, which I will talk about later in the video because I love Mycenaean archaeology. So he rocks up with Clytemnestra with Cassandra. There's a lot of long names.
They're very similar as well. Yeah. It doesn't help.
And he's like, "Hey, where are my kids?" And she's like, "I don't know, inside, waiting for you." And he's like, "Okay, cool, I'm gonna come in now." She's like, "Cool." And then he comes in, I believe they have a feast. And then, once they have the feast, she's like, "I'm gonna run you a bath." And he's like, "Yay, my wife's running me a bath." I don't think he thinks is strange. I don't know if it is strange for your wife queen to run you a bath.
Yeah, surely that's like something like, I mean, I was gonna say something, but a slave would do.
Yeah, they have slaves. Yeah. They have lots of slaves. She runs him a bath, and then she kind of, while he's in the bath, I believe he's like fallen asleep or he's resting, and she puts this tunic over his head while he's in the bath, but she's sewn the head and the arms. So she basically just puts a sack over his head so he can't, like, wriggle around.
Right.
And then she murders him with an axe.
Lovely. And honestly, I don't really blame her.
No! In some stories, in the Odyssey...
I don't like this guy.
Yeah, in the Odyssey, it's Aegisthus who kills him. And I believe in Aesculapius, it's Clytemnestra, and then in Euripides, it's Aegisthus. It gets really confusing, right. Because obviously I do this a lot for uni, but I've read so many different translations of these plays because this is like my favorite play, like cohort of plays, that it kind of gets blurred. But
so no one can really make up their mind.
No.
And so everyone just says different things.
Yeah.
Which is helpful.
It is. It's very helpful. But it is their own work. They're not, like...
Yeah.
She kills him, which is amazing. The king of Mycenae is dead. Wow, what are we going to do now? The only real thing is we instate the killer and her lover, slash also maybe the killer, as the king and queen.
Honestly, slay.
They can't, like, they don't really have a choice. I think they kind of just did it themselves.
They're
We're running this. Sorry, my elbow's really annoying me. they kind of just instate themselves and are kind of like ruling as, we don't really have this concept of dictators in palatial Greece, but they are kind of acting as
it's modern, basically dictating.
Modern dictators, not the ancient form of dictators, which is like Julius Caesar and like other people. But yeah, and also while all of this is happening, the children, obviously the children exist. So Elektra gets word. Again, this changes depending on what play you're reading. So Elektra gets word that this has happened, and she's really scared for Orestes, because Orestes is the heir. Orestes is Agamemnon's heir. So she sends him away. She basically just gives him to, I believe, a shepherd who lives on the lands and is loyal to Agamemnon, and she sends him to live with one of their cousins.
So for protection, because obviously, like, Clytemnestra and her lover, if they have a child who's male, would be the heir, so they need to protect the Agamemnon's heir, basically,
In some stories, it's actually Clytemnestra who sends him away. I can kind of...
Interesting choice,
More... I mean, I can see both routes plausibly happening. Yeah. In my own version of it, I can definitely see Clytemnestra doing it. I mean, she does love her children, but she makes some questionable mothering choices.
Well, but you can see, like, if with this, like, new, like, sort of dictatorship, if they want to secure a new line completely away from Agamemnon, then you could see why.
Yeah. She wants wouldn't to erase him the trace of Agamemnon.
Yeah.
Which, that's hard. He's a big presence. But yeah, Elektra's old enough to get married at this point. And they refuse to marry her to anyone, which in itself is a crime. I believe it's like a desecration of like maiden rights or something. And Clytemnestra basically keeps her locked in the house for a couple of years. There's in Euripides' Elektra, I believe it's the Velikot translation. Apparently Aegisthus is like, he's like very sacrilegious. He desecrates Agamemnon's tomb. They don't sacrifice to him. They don't even bury him properly, which is like the worst thing you can do in
it. Yeah, that's like the worst thing you can do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they don't bury him properly. And I believe Elektra is the one who has to bury him with the help of people who are loyal to her. And Elektra continues to grow up in this household. Orestes is gone. Chrysothemis is present, but her presence is, it kind of reads as maybe a sister who was too young to kind of understand what was going on. But we actually see her in, I believe it's Euripides' Elektra. Oh, no, it's not. Maybe it's Orestes by Euripides. Yes, I think it's Orestes by Euripides. Clytemnestra sends her to sacrifice things to the tomb of Agamemnon, and Chrysothemis is happily going to do so, and then Elektra's like, you can't take her sacrifices. It's a disgrace against the gods, and Chrysothemis is like, okay. and is like, okay, I'll
sacrifice. So quite impressionable.
Yeah, she seems quite sweet. She's kind of normal compared to Orestes and Elektra, who are, in lack of a better word, fucking mental.
So that does suggest that she's younger.
Yeah, she's either younger than them, she's normal. Which I don't know how. I think she's probably older than Orestes, though.
Right.
I don't know, because I can't tell. It's hard to tell. But yeah, so Chrysothemis is in the house, Elektra's in the house. Chrysothemis doesn't get married off, which also, they don't mention her marriageable age, so she probably is younger than Elektra, actually. But Elektra's talking about, the chorus is talking about how Elektra has loads and loads of suitors, and they won't let her get married to any of them, and they've instead married her to a peasant farmer, which is... again, kind of, like, desecrating the memory of Agamemnon.
Well, yeah, like, that's an insult. So, do they not want her to marry because they don't want to continue Agamemnon's life? Right, yes. Yeah, okay. I follow.
One of my favourite passages is her talking about how she's married to this peasant farmer, but she won't sleep with him because she doesn't want to ruin herself.
Yeah, so she still almost wants to have, like, a marriage with someone who she can continue her father's line with.
Yeah, she talks about how she's somebody's wife, so virgin girls won't accept her, but married women won't accept her because they know she's still, she's not consummated her marriage, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's kind of stuck in this, like, limbo. And also Electra, like, the whole play of Electra is so sad because we can really see, like, specifically her, and I mean Orestes and Chrysothemis too, really not dealing at all with how things have gone with their family. They're so disgusted by their mother, they almost can't fathom it. And Electra, like, the way she talks about her father is so sad. Like, obviously she doesn't see him for 10 years, and like, he's the king of kings and he's this huge figure and it's her father, he's, you know, head to head.
So she's grown up more with, like, stories of him, as
Depending on how old she was, she definitely remembers him. She definitely remembers him because she talks about him as such. But, and she even goes as, like, one thing I noticed when reading translations is when she's talking to Clytemnestra about how dirty she's done them, she always refers to Iphigenia as your daughter, and very scarcely refers to her as my sister. And
right,
whereas Orestes, she kind of only refers to as my brother. So she's kind of, we kind of see this rejection of Iphigenia, probably out of, like, a naivety, and she kind of can't deal with maybe what her father's done, or she just views it as a necessity that he had to do in order to fight the war. Electra's very duty driven.
Yeah, and very forgiving of her father, clearly, if
she
puts this aside.
I think she's not stupid. I think she understands how the world works, and she's like, he's a good king. Well, that's arguable. But he's doing what he's doing for a reason. And, you know, she's young. But, yeah. So she marries this peasant farmer, and the peasant farmer, it's such an odd book. Honestly, like, he's like, keeps talking about how he's not gonna have sex with her, even though he could, and maybe he wants to, but he's not gonna desecrate Agamemnon's daughter, but if she was anyone else, he would. And it's like,
it's just, weird. Yeah.
But also, at the same time, depending on what translation you read, it's kind of sweet. Like, Rem's translation is kind of like that, whereas Velikot's translation is like, I would never touch this woman out of respect for her.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't her ideals. Touch this woman with a stick. Yeah.
Yeah. And they literally are living in a hut on the side of a mountain, which very different from what she's grown up with. But so she wants Orestes to come back. She hasn't seen him for years.
Mm-hmm.
I gather at this point it's probably been like another 5 to 10 years, maybe.
Yeah.
And she's married. She's the only thing she has to sacrifice to her father is her hair, so she's like, most of her hair's shaven. She's constantly in this state of mourning that isn't really acceptable past the average mourning period in Greece.
Right.
So the chorus is kind of constantly being like, girl, you've got to move on and deal with things. And she's like, no. And I believe the chorus is village girls in this specific play. And they're all like, come out with us. And she's like, no, I'm mourning. And chops off, lobs off.
It's giving Miss Havisham, isn't it?
I don't know who that is.
You know, Great Expectations. What? Oh, is it? If you guys have read Great Expectations, you'll know exactly what I mean.
Okay, I might have to read that now.
Yeah.
But yeah, and then she goes to get water. Her husband is like, I'm going to get water, and she's like, no, husband, let me do something for you. And then she goes and gets the water, and then bitches like to the chorus, this man keeps making me go get water. And I'm like, girl, he offered. We'll have to put in an excerpt of the two scenes next to each other or something, because that's like one of my favorites.
So funny.
Yeah. The Orestia, like, the collection of the Orestia is it's not supposed to be a comedy, but sometimes they say really funny things.
Yeah.
I'll talk about another line that everyone finds really funny afterwards. but yeah, and she goes to get water, and then these two guys turn up with like swords, and they're like rugged, and they're like boys who look like they're on the run. And it's Orestes and Pylades. I'm going to say Pylades. And they're kind of gay. Yeah.
But history would say they were besties.
Literally, they don't get the Achilles and Patroclus treatment, in the sense that most historians and most scholars are like, oh yeah, they were fucking. Orestes and Pylades kind of get this kind of like, maybe they are, maybe they aren't vibe. We can't tell. I can tell.
your historic gaydar is unmatched.
It's off the charts. If you, Vibi, so you know. Anyway. Yeah, different episode.
Yeah.
But yeah, they show up and Orestes is talking to Pylades. He's like, I've come to look for my sister. I've heard that she's ruined herself and is no longer a virgin. And when I'm reading this, he's quite young. He's 15 to 20, and he's been raised kind of, like, this boy, it's insane, but also he's kind of relatable, and Electra shows up again, and she's really scared, because these two men are, like, outside of a hut, rambling at each other. And they look scary. And then Orestes is like, ew, who's this ugly slave? Who's this ugly slave girl?
Jesus!
And I can't tell, based on the scene, who recognises who first. But they work it out. And they recognise each other. And it's like, oh, happy, yay. And Electra... Actually, they've been invited into Electra's husband's house. And Electra comes in and she's like, dude, you're poor. You've got to stop inviting people into our house. We don't have any money.
I just love the way you explain these things.
It's what happens. Yeah. She's like, dude, you're married to a princess and you're broke as fuck. And he's like, but these two men are outside and they're gay and they wanted to come in. And they're loyal to Agamemnon. And I think that's when she starts to realize.
Yeah,
and he's like, I'm looking for my sister Electra, and she's like, I have a brother, and he's also looking for his sister Electra. Yeah, but yeah, they recognize each other, and then immediately these little freaks are like, we have to murder our mother. And it's
Jesus Christ. It's like,
yeah, of course you do. That's exactly what you need to do. So they establish, actually, that Clytemnestra and Aegisthus have had other children.
Right.
And that they're kind of ruling tyrannically. That's what I was looking for. Tyrant, not dictator. Different context. And they're not doing good. And Clytemnestra won't come and see Electra. And she's desecrated her by putting her in this marriage. Take a shot every time I've said the word desecrated in this episode.
Jesus.
But, yeah. And she's like, I know what we're going to do. We're going to pretend I've had a baby and just given birth. And I'm in my confinement period. And I need someone to come sacrifice to my child. Sacrifice to my child, not sacrifice my child.
Okay.
Big difference, Agamemnon. And she does. They send word. Clytemnestra shows up. Orestes murders her.
Nice.
She knows it's him. She recognizes him. And she's like, my children, don't murder me. And it's quite sad. And there's another version where they go to the palace, they murder Aegisthus first, and then she sees that Aegisthus is murdered. And she's like, how could you do that? And he's like, how could you kill our father? And then she actually, like, opens her tunic dress chiton thing. And she's like, kill me in the breast that I suckled you from.
Oof.
Yeah.
Oof.
He does.
Damn. Jesus.
And he does it, and Orestes immediately regrets it. Orestes and Electra immediately crash out, basically. They start to kind of lose it a little bit. And Pylades is like, guys, he helped murder just as Clytemnestra. And he's like, guys, like, you kind of just have to get over it a little bit. And then we get that cute quote that everyone on TikTok loves, which is, like, I'll take care of you, by Pylades. It's rotten work, not to me, not if it's you.
Right.
Which is something we see quite often. Same with Theseus and Heracles and other heroes. It's quite a common thing where, like, friendship surpasses the miasma. It's like, yay! But yeah, they kill their mother. And...
lovely, yeah.
Then a bunch of different stuff starts to happen. It kind of, if you didn't think it was crazy already, it starts to get insane. In Euripides' version of things, or at least in one version of Euripides' things, they call their uncle for help because they're about to be stoned by the village for killing their mom.
So Jesus Christ!
They call Menelaus and
this
Helen.
Is just...
and they're like, hey, uncle, we kind of murdered our mom because they killed your brother and you've been useless and haven't helped us. And he's like, yeah, sure, I'll help. And he turns up and he kind of just like, I'm not gonna help you guys.
Nice.
And Helen's also there and she's like, she's really funny. Helen's really sassy. She just does not care about what's going on. And Helen is Clytemnestra's sister. I'm like, girl, you should care. And she does care in Orestes, Euripides. She's quite sad over it. But then Orestes and Electra's cool new idea is, let's murder Menelaus.
Oh my God.
Helen and their daughter Hermione and then run away.
Can they just stop murdering people? Jesus. Also, it's getting a bit out of hand.
Also,
you got your revenge.
I skipped over this part a bit because it's really confusing and I kind of hate reading Orestes' parts when he's not talking to Electra, but Apollo basically is the one who tells Orestes to kill Clytemnestra. He's like, you've got to do it, bro.
So the gods are influencing.
Apollo's like, bro, you better kill her. I'm not having this. And he's like, Jesus. Sure. But yeah, So they go into Helen's chambers and they're both like, we're going to pretend, Electra's going in there and she's like, I'm going to pretend that I'm really sad and I'm begging for forgiveness. And while she's doing that, Pylades and Orestes are going to come in and murder her. So she starts begging and then they start coming in and killing her. But then Zeus, who is Helen's father, by the way.
Yeah.
She was born from an egg. It's the whole leader and swan thing.
Yeah.
Zeus is Helen's father through he assaulted Helen's mother in the guise of a swan and she gave birth to an egg and that egg is Helen.
Lovely, yeah.
And
pretty standard for Zeus though, to be honest.
Like, hey, no, you can't kill my daughter, and just kind of whisks her up to heaven. She doesn't die. Heaven.
Right.
Olympus, sorry.
Yeah.
I was Mary brained. yeah. I keep saying she goes up to heaven, Olympus, and she just becomes a god. So she's been in Troy for 10 years. Menelaus gets her back and then the gods are like, oop, she's ours now. So that's
god, give this girl a break, Jesus.
So then Electra and Orestes are like, oh god, now we're gonna have to do something else. So they kidnap Hermione, who is Helen and Menelaus's daughter, dangle her off a roof in front of Menelaus and is like, oi, we're gonna kill her because you didn't help us. And he's like, no. And they're like, we're gonna do it. And they don't even, they're not even ransoming him. They're just gonna kill her.
Jesus Christ, talk about trauma.
And then Apollo comes down and Apollo is like, okay, you guys have taken this a bit
too far.
Bit far. And he marries Orestes to Hermione, as you do.
Right, okay.
Keeps lovely. Helen as a god and is like, Menelaus, go help them. And then it gets even weirder. The Furies.
It gets even weirder now.
The Furies. turn up. The Furies are like these kind of spirit things, forces, malevolent things who enact justice in ancient Greece.
I just feel like with every new plot point, I'm just losing my mind just like a little bit more.
Also, Pylades and Electra get married at the same time as Hermione and Orestes.
Okay.
So she divorces the farmer, I guess.
Okay, so the farmer just buggers off, basically.
He never gets mentioned again. Yeah.
Oh, poor guy.
Poor guy, I know. I don't even know if they gave him any money. That's so sad.
Yeah.
But yeah, Orestes and Hermione get married. Hermione was actually married to Neoptolemus, who is Achilles' son, but he dies as well, so yeah.
Right.
And then Pylades and Electra are married, and then they kind of disappear from the narrative, but then Orestes has still murdered his mother, which is still a crime, and it's kind of this, like, juxtaposition of you've enacted revenge and served justice, but you've also murdered your mother, and those two things kind of,
they cancel each other out.
Not really, like, they but kind like of, they can't cancel each other out, if that makes sense.
Right,
like,
yeah,
they can't coexist on the same thing. I don't know. And there's a lot of monologues about that. It's like, is it not just to avenge my father, but it's unjust to it be at the hands of my mother. It's
right,
the whole point of the play is kind of based around, is vengeance on your kin okay if your kin has
wronged you
in a way that is offensive to the gods. And yeah, Orestes then goes to Athens and he's
quick holiday,
getting chased by the Furies and he's going insane, and then they have a trial. Apollo and Athena set up a trial, and like a literal courthouse trial. This is what we get the original conception of a trial from, this play, out of all the plays picked. And Apollo's defense is, and this is horribly misogynistic, and I hate when people have this argument that the whole entirety of this myth and this mythos is misogynistic because of this one play, when it's one play out of like seven.
Yeah.
Apollo's argument is, well, mothers aren't really that important because they're just incubators. He just murdered his incubator. Who cares?
Oh, Jesus.
And he wins. And Orestes gets off scot-free, I guess, apart from being insane and having committed an atrocity. And then nothing else happens.
Jesus.
Yeah, but there is a different play by Euripides called Iphigenia Amongst the Taurians, in which Iphigenia didn't get sacrificed. She actually got swapped for a deer, and actually she's been in this temple this entire time making human sacrifices of foreigners who show up on the island, and then Orestes gets sent to the island for the murder of his mother, and he meets Iphigenia, and she's about to murder him, and they're having a conversation, and then while they're having the conversation, they realize they're siblings.
Right,
and then they kind of all just reunite, and it's like a happy ending. And this is written near the end of Euripides' career, where he starts to get really goofy with his plays. In one play, like, Helen is not ever in Troy. She never gets abducted. They fall for a ghost.
It's not like version. The whole point.
They fall for a ghost version of Helen. And Helen's been in Egypt the entire time.
Of course, yeah.
And yeah, it's ridiculous. But this family is crazy, and Euripides and Asclepius should pay for their crimes. But yeah, that's pretty much the narrative version of everything.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Oh my god, it's just, honestly, at every plot point, I was like, it can't get worse, and it just, it went and got worse.
Yeah, imagine having to write essays about this.
Jeez. So, lots of trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of trauma resulting in revenge and taking things too far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's, Jesus Christ. I think I did follow, though. I did follow. I was able to follow. At first, I was like, okay, there's lots of people.
I mean, like, at first, it seems like there's lots of people, but then it kind of just boils down to, like, Orestes, Electra, and Clytemnestra. So.
Yeah, once most people have, like, died, it's easier to follow because, like, you're remembering less people's names.
Exterminated. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
Jesus. Oh, my gosh.
Mm. I kind of want to reflect on the play as a whole really, really quick. I'll be quick. But I do love this play because I do think it is really nuanced. And it's not even nuanced in the, like, modern conceptualization of it. Like, maybe, I don't know, like, Medea kind of gets a very modern treatment.
Yes, yeah.
Oedipus doesn't really. Oedipus is kind of like, married his mom, that's about it. But these stories, by all of the playwrights, it kind of really focuses on the nuance of being betrayed by your parents and how you deal with that as a person.
I'm pleasantly surprised. I think it's really interesting the way they explore it, because there's so many different, like, because they're betrayed by their parents, like, in two very different ways. Like, I feel like Electra, because obviously there's the first betrayal of, like, her father being murdered, but then there's also the trying to erase, like, her father's line by marrying her to a peasant.
Yeah.
And like, sending away.
That I am not anti-Clytemnestra at all. Yeah. I think lots of things can be true, and I think they can even be true for Agamemnon, because he swore an oath to Menelaus and Helen that he would do whatever, and to the gods, and these are oaths that, like, you have to uphold. And I mean, if a god requests you to kill your child, it's kind of like this.
We
tackle with it in most religions, and I think this is where Abrahamic religions get a bit like, we're better than the pagans because we didn't actually murder our child in the story of, I think it's Abraham and Isaac. It's kind of like Agamemnon had this duty to his brother, and is his duty to one of his kin higher than the duty to the rest of his kin? Not excusing Agamemnon at all, but, and then Clytemnestra in the same breath, does she not owe her daughter vengeance for that death? And she's a grieving mother. And even though she is written to be morally corrupt and wrong, I think now we see this mother who watched her daughter get slaughtered like an animal. Literally, an animal.
And that's, like, unforgivable, obviously.
Yeah, and was, she was, like, tricked by her husband. And then we see Electra and Orestes, who are dealing with their father being gone and their father being this great figurehead, and then their father finally returning home, and they've kind of got this sense that they can breathe and they can relax and maybe things will go back to normal, and then he gets murdered by their mother. And also they've grown up in the court with Aegisthus while their father's been gone, so they've seen their mother ruin their father's kingdom and ruin his memory while he's alive, while he's in Troy, by having such a public affair. Like, Aegisthus is kind of instated as king while Agamemnon is gone, which is insane. But then we also see Clytemnestra coping the only way she can with vengeance. And she does... I forgot to mention it. But she does actually kill Cassandra.
Yeah, I kind of saw that coming.
Sorry,
I'm surprised.
I did forget
like...
to mention that.
Yeah.
But I can... People take it different ways. People take it as mercy because obviously Cassandra has been cursed with the prophecy.
Yeah.
Her entire family has been murdered or sold into slavery. And she's cursed. And she's living a horrible life. And she's... I mean, you know, she's not going to do well. And then Clytemnestra either murders her out of sympathy or just because she's mad. I don't think you can really blame Clytemnestra for that, because what's she going to do with Cassandra?
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
she kind of puts
there's
her
no...
out of her misery.
Yeah, there's no good or bad guys. That's the thing. Well, there's like bad guys. It's all
there's
very
bad
morally.
Guys. And
great.
Then there's everyone else.
yeah.
And then Orestes and Electra are very much, I don't use this word lightly, they are abused by Clytemnestra.
Yeah.
Like, she treats them horribly, specifically Electra. She treats them horribly.
Mm.
And it ends badly for all of them. No one really gets a happy ending.
Exactly, and that's why it's a tragedy.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, so many of these themes, like, end up creating what we see as a tragedy today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's very extreme. That's the thing with it. Because, like, I feel like tragedies, they've almost gotten, like, softer, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, this is, like, extremely just insane. And it's really interesting because the narrative makes you, like, understand, like, their actions. Mm. But also, you want to judge them at the same time.
You are, yeah.
And I feel like as human beings, when we're reading a narrative, like when watching a film or like reading a book, we're looking for like the hero and the villain. Whereas like this is just so muddled that like there isn't one.
And I do think there is probably something to say that a lot of the people reading it at the time would probably be a lot more pro Agamemnon.
Yeah.
Because obviously it's what they used to. I need to express that by the time these plays are written, majority of Greece is not being run by like kings and like dynastic families in the way they were previously. So we get this timeline of Mycenaean Greece, which these stories are being set. In like Agamemnon, like the Iliad, the Trojan War, all of this stuff, they're really being run by one person, all of the kingdoms. And then by the time we get to democratic Athens, this is looked down upon, but they're still very much looking back on this golden age of the Greeks and thinking this is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then they're writing a lot of tragedies about these plays, and you can kind of see where the democratic side of things are slipping in, and they're kind of saying these things don't
and morality
work.
It's really interesting, honestly. I'm blown away by it. Like, I feel like I'm gonna be like sat like thinking about like what are my thoughts, like,
yeah,
because there's no right answer. Like, you can't
it's
pick
nuanced.
A side, because there's and you don't get that with stories anymore. You really don't get that. You always most stories there is a right and a wrong,
arguably,
but yeah,
the most similar in a modern, very modern context is Succession.
Oh my god.
And I have talked about this on my TikTok a lot, the comparison of the Succession siblings to the Atreus siblings, but if you want to check that out, check out my TikTok.
It's really interesting, because the whole point of storytelling since like dawn of time is there being a moral to a story and something for people to learn from. And what's so interesting about this is I feel like as a society, when it comes to like telling stories, is we've tried to like, it's almost like stories act like we're a bit like stupid these days, and it's like we need to really clearly show them what's right and what's wrong. Whereas like with this, it's like there is a moral to the story, but like it's not as clear, and I feel like everyone gets their just desserts, you know.
And I'm not gonna get into religious discourse, but I do genuinely feel, and there's probably a lot of scholarship to back this up, that the idea of good and bad really takes form in the late Roman Empire when Christianity starts to get really popular.
And because there's heaven and hell, there's God and the devil.
God and the devil, which we don't have in Greek mythology. We don't have in the Greek pantheon. We don't even really have in the Roman pantheon. I mean, there are lots of stories where there's good and evil, but also there's a lot of stories where the gods are enactors of justice and divine retribution, and a lot of the times that divine retribution isn't positive, and they're doing what they will. They're very human, and there's right and wrong, but also the gods
That's what's so interesting about Greek mythology, is that the gods are so human in terms of their emotions and their actions, and you don't get that. Obviously, like, I will always compare it to Christianity, because like both of us have grown up Christian, and like there really isn't that, like, I mean, there's the flood and everything, but you don't see in Christianity the idea of like God lashing out on humans in the same way that like in Greek mythology.
Not in the New Testament, though.
Yeah, in the Old Testament, oh my God, it's like Jesus is like, here, have a few plagues. Yeah. You know, you're pissing me off. Have some plagues. But obviously, I don't know if like this is right, but I can see that the Old Testament being more influenced by
the Old Testament Greek mythology and stuff. Roughly around the same time that paganism would have been quite popular, because obviously it's Jewish. Torah.
So yes.
Judaism is flourishing around the time of Romans and Greeks.
Yeah. It's all like, that's what's so interesting about religion, is that it's all mixed in. Like, I can't remember what it was I was watching the other day, or I was listening to, and it's like, I honestly can't remember what it is. I might have even been having a conversation with you.
Maybe.
But it's like, the idea of the Virgin Mary is in like all religions. Like, there is a figure, like, there is a virgin birth in like,
yeah, it was me.
All religions. Yeah, was it you? Yeah.
Yeah. Not to stray away, but...
Oh, yeah, we are straying a bit. That's my bad.
It's okay. No, I brought it up. I don't know. I feel like this family is very nuanced. There's a lot of retellings of this family.
Yeah. Do you wanna show some of your favourites? Because I know you've got, like, some books with you.
I've probably read 7 retellings about this family.
Jesus. Oh,
which
my
is
God.
A lot. But I have ones in my bookshelf because it's a hardback and I can't be bothered to get it out. But this is Clytemnestra's Bind by Susan C. Wilson. I think I rated this like 3.5 out of 5. It was fine. It's good. It was an enjoyable read. It was a very different take on things compared to the other ones. And it's very pro Clytemnestra. Like, extremely so, to the point where you kind of lack a little bit of the nuance that I want to see from these retellings.
And it must be so hard to retell, especially with, like, what we're talking about modern narratives is, like, readers want to pick a side. So, like, almost as a writer, you have to pick a side with who you're telling it from.
This version covers the idea that Clytemnestra was married previously, which that's part of mythology, but I didn't want to confuse things. She's married before she's married to Agamemnon, and he murders her son and her husband in order to marry her.
Yeah,
but that's not a very popular myth, and it doesn't make its way into the plays, so I didn't touch on that. But if you do want to read that is a good book for it. House of Names by Colm Tobin. It's Irish, I should know. This is not a very old retelling. I believe it's like 90s, 2000s. But this is really good. I love Colm Tobin's writing. He's a brilliant writer. I read it when I was quite young. I think I was about 14 when I read this. So I do need to give it a reread. But from my memory, I'd probably give it about like a four stars.
Four or five, yeah.
Yeah. And then we have My Baby,
yeah.
Electra by Jennifer Saint. People have pros and cons with Jennifer Saint. I also have pros and cons with Jennifer Saint, but I love this book. I love this book so much. One, the cover is beautiful.
Oh, all her covers are absolutely gorgeous, yeah.
I read this in probably like 3 days and have read it again since. And I sobbed like a little baby on the beach reading this. It's really good. It to me, gave a lot of nuance. I think maybe it villainizes Clytemnestra slightly more because it's maybe a bit more focused on Electra, but I still thought it was brilliant. I also read Daughters, it's like the Sisters of Sparta or Daughters of Sparta, it's somewhere in my bookshelf. Mm-hmm. I believe it's by Elodie Harper. I'll correct that if not. But that was really good. It was a bit more simple than the others.
Yeah.
The prose was a bit more simple, which I didn't have a hard time with it. It just didn't like entice me the way I wanted it to. And then there's another one, which is Clytemnestra by Constanza. I haven't actually finished that. I've started it. I haven't finished it. It's at uni, so I will finish it when I get back. But I enjoyed that. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, we'll have a list down below. I don't know, like, you might have seen on our social media, we always post, like, our sources and, like, readings and stuff mm-hmm. that, like, we looked at for the episodes. So all of that will be in the description, so you can go and check them out if you want to do some more reading on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah.
I don't know if you've got to say anything else.
Yeah, I think we've covered like quite a lot. Mm. And considering this is the episode we were like least prepared for,
yeah,
I think we've done a pretty good job. So.
Yeah, I think I've talked the most. I talked more about this than I did Sabina, which is crazy.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting because it really makes you think just about like, obviously like the narrative itself, but also just like the history of like tragedy and like how we perceive stories and stuff. It's just, honestly, it's really, really interesting. Yeah.
We will provide a list of the translations of the plays that I've read. And yeah, I think I want to do more episodes about the plays, specifically Heracles. I do love Heracles.
Yeah, I need a Heracles episode because I want to learn more.
That's probably my favourite play. That's the play that really got me into Greek mythology. Yeah, I think it's all done. Do you want to talk about what we're doing next episode or?
Next episode, yes. Yeah. Okay, so next episode, it will be my week again.
Yes.
So next week, we are going to be talking about corsets.
Yay!
And the history of corsets. So different from what we've talked about this episode, which is kind of why, like, I'm loving this podcast because literally we just, like, we take it in turns each week and we talk about whatever we want.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so next week we'll be talking about corsets from the history of the garment itself, like where it came from, to the controversies surrounding it, both in Victorian times and today, the myths, like there is so much to unpack with it. Like, I love corsets. I wrote one of my essays in college about corsets and corsetry and the idea of like it being used like in a modern capacity, so we'll be touching on that as well. I will be getting very angry at certain films. But yeah, I'm very excited for this episode. Honestly, I cannot wait. And yeah, so tune in next week to see that because it's going to be a good one.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so thank you so much for watching this episode, for watching all the way to the end, because I think this is probably going to be our longest episode so far. So thank you so much for watching, listening, whether on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Really appreciate it. Thank you for all the love on previous episodes. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a like.
Yes.
It would mean the world.
Yes,
subscribe for more. And you can follow us on social media for sneak peeks, our sources and reading lists. Maria loves posting memes on our TikTok. Yeah. So definitely go check those out, because honestly, they're hilarious. I love them when she sends them to me. So yeah, thank you so much for listening. We love you. Thank you so much. Yeah. And we'll see you next week.
See you.
Bye.